is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer and healthier and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Did you ever overeat and then you felt bad because you overate and then you started beating yourself up and you said, oh, all is lost, and then you really binged? There has to be a better way. Dr. Michelle May says, trash the guilt, trash the rules, enjoy eating and lose weight as well. Rather than feeling trapped, she teaches confident, fearless eating. Dr. May is a board-certified family physician and author of Am I Hungry? What to Do When Diets Don't Work, and also author of the CD Stop Dieting and Start Living. Back in February, Dr. May taught us how to know when we're hungry as opposed to eating for emotional reasons. Today, we're going to focus on how to enjoy eating more and lose weight at the same time. And in the second part of the show, we'll focus on how to enjoy eating and lose weight even when you're on the road, when you're on vacation, at a McDonald's, or a Starbucks. Dr. May, I'm delighted to have you back with us.
My pleasure.
In your book and in your lectures, you talk about how you yourself were a yo-yo dieter. How did that experience change your life and who you are and how you relate to people?
It's really interesting because I think we have an image of ourselves of a certain way, and on the outside, my image didn't match what I was experiencing on the inside. I see that a lot in people. There are a lot of people out there who are very successful in their careers. They're running families. They're very prominent people. They're really successful on the outside. But they oftentimes struggle with eating. And I think that that incongruence creates problems for us. And it was certainly creating problems for me.
So what was your image of yourself?
As a physician, I loved my practice. I had lots of wonderful patients, and I was very good at what I call advice giving, trying to help people recognize the changes that they needed to make to live a healthier lifestyle. But behind all of that, I saw that I wasn't really following my own advice very consistently. And for a long time, I felt guilty about that. And then it dawned on me one day that maybe that advice just isn't that good of advice. Maybe what I was asking the people to do that I wasn't able to do really was not the best approach to solving the problem.
So then what did you do?
I stopped dieting. I mean, I know it sounds too simple, but at some point I just said, you know, I'm done. I am just so done with this. And I'm sure that many of the people that you work with feel the same way. At some point you say, if it's not working, I just can't keep doing this. I felt like I was beating my head against the wall. What I didn't expect, though, was as soon as I stopped dieting, I actually began to feel better. And I actually had less problems with weight gain, overeating, the guilt, the shame that was associated with eating certain foods. That was a bit of a surprise to me at first, but it's not a surprise to me anymore because I've seen it happen to thousands of people as they give up that fear and guilt around food.
So was a lot of emotional turmoil that was just sapping a lot of your energy and confidence?
Yeah, I think emotional turmoil is a good way to put it. It doesn't mean that every one of us that struggle with our weight have deep, dark psychological issues. I really don't believe that. I think for a lot of us, we just have developed habits, ways of taking care of ourselves, ways of meeting our needs that in the long run are not as productive or they come with strings attached. For me, it was some boredom, some stress, some habits, some avoidance, those kinds of things. And I think for each person, it's going to be different. What they're struggling with, what their triggers are, will vary from time to time.
You certainly don't have to have deep psychological problems to struggle with weight. If that were the case, over half our country wouldn't be in therapy. But as you said, you know, you develop the habits and you get into this boxing match with yourself, with the internal dialogue.
Yeah, I think the internal dialogue is really important. And what really struck me through this process is that one of my most powerful triggers was actually the deprivation and the restriction. so as I realized that, yeah, I ate because I was stressed sometimes, sometimes it was because I was bored, sometimes it was because it tasted good or it was fun, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that I felt deprived of certain foods, and so when I would break out of that restraint and begin to eat those foods, I'd eventually overeat those foods. That guilt seemed to drive that overeating, just as you said at the top of the show. It really becomes a vicious cycle, and it wasn't until I broke out of it that I realized how powerful it was for me.
I think some people have mental counters where they say, well, it's been 5 days, or it's been so many calories, I've restricted myself, and then the dam bursts.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, the thing about it is that it takes a tremendous amount of energy to have this mental calculation going on all the time. This self-talk that is always there, oh, I shouldn't eat that, oh, but I want it, oh, I've been so good, oh, I'll spend an extra hour on the treadmill. When you think about the way that distracts us from living our real lives, from fulfilling our true purpose, from being happy, from being present in the current moment, I think it's more than just the weight on the scale. I think it's the weight on our shoulders that ultimately takes its toll.
Yeah, even when we're not stressed, our short-term memory can only track about 5 to 7 things at a time. And if 1 or 2 or 3 of those channels is tied up with worrying about food and calories, there's not that much left to tune into real life.
Yeah, our bandwidth gets narrowed significantly.
Sounds like my computer, but mindfulness is one of those words that I think I know what it means, but then again, I'm not sure. And to use an analogy, it reminds me of prayer. We all know what prayer is, but wait a minute. There are people who say the same ritualistic prayer that's been said for thousands of years in a holy language. And there are people that spontaneously say their own prayers from their hearts and everything in between. What does mindfulness and mindful eating mean to you?
Love that question, because you're right. It means different things to different people, and sometimes I'm even reluctant to use that term because it can be loaded. But to me, in its most simple form, it's about being totally present in this moment. And of course, this is the only moment that we have. We can't do anything about the past, and the future is yet to occur. So when we get completely present here and mindful about what's going on, we can experience that moment fully.
A lot of thinking about mindfulness came from Buddha's teaching. For a lot of Westerners, Buddha and meditation and breathing exercises, we feel like we don't have the patience for it. It's a cultural makeover. How does someone with a Western mindset become mindful and living in the present without getting in a lotus position and chanting?
Right, right. And that's a great question, because I'm not Buddhist. I'm very Westernized in my thinking. But I also recognize that some of this very Western thinking that causes us to resist the idea of being present and mindful is also what's causing a lot of our problems. So let me give an example in the food world. Oftentimes, when we're eating, we're not thinking about the food in our mouth. We're thinking about the next forkful. We're loading it. We're shoveling our food around the plate. So we're not even tasting what's there. And the challenge with that, of course, is if I'm loading my next forkful, then I'm not done until there are no more forkfuls.
Okay.
Interestingly, people will clean an entire plate and not feel satisfied because they never tasted the food that was actually in their mouth at the time. So that's a good example of how living often the future causes us to miss the wonderful tastes and pleasures that are right here in the present.
So how do we fully taste that mouthful of food?
That's so wonderful. It is really about noticing, becoming fully aware, and again, not in a woo-woo sense, but it's about waking up for just a minute and saying, oh, wait a minute, I realized that my mind drifted off for a moment. How does this food in my mouth taste right now? Noticing tastes, textures, temperatures, aromas. It's interesting because our tongue actually only has 4 flavors. It detects salty, sweet, bitter, and sour. All of the rest of the flavors come from the aromas of the food. So that's funny, because when people are shoveling big mouthfuls of food very fast and they're not breathing and their mouth is so full that air can't get up to their nose, they're not even tasting most of the flavors that are in the food in the first place.
Okay, so let's say that we're not shoveling. We put that in our mouth. We fully tasted it. And then we're putting another bite into the same spaghetti or whatever. How do you get that second bite to be interesting and keep your attention too, as opposed to, well, been there, done that. I already tasted this. I know what it tastes like.
Right, right. We jumped ahead a little bit in the process because before you ever even put food in your mouth, we really have to start back a few steps. So if you don't mind, I'm going to take a couple steps backwards in order to move forward. Before we can ever sit down and begin to eat, you first have to really even know whether you're hungry or not. And as you said, we talked about that in a previous interview. I think it's a step that a lot of people overlook. If you are not hungry at all, it's very hard for the food to engage your attention. So the way that shows up in our lives is we're feeling stressed, so we run down to the candy machine at work and we buy something that's forbidden on our diet or on our healthy eating plan, and we eat it while we're walking back to our desk, and it's gone before we ever even get there. We don't enjoy it, we don't feel satisfied by it, and we could actually eat another two or three before we'd even recognize how miserable we could because we weren't hungry in the first place. So although it seems really basic, you have to at least know whether you're eating because your body needs the fuel or you're just purely eating for pleasure or some other reason.
And what you were describing is very much what we do with drugs.
Oh, yeah. It's almost this distraction, this avoidance, this smoke screen between what's really going on and experiencing the present moment.
And a lot of this is a band-aid on our emotions. So we've got eating for nutrition and pleasure, and then we've got the emotional eating that's kind of like the drug habit.
Exactly, exactly. And I like that you said eating for nutrition and pleasure as one thing, because I think sometimes our society gets so fixated on eating for health and all the latest nutrition data and the latest scientific study and research and products, that sometimes we forget that pleasure is a really important part of eating and that we don't get satisfaction just from having a full tummy, but we get satisfaction when we taste our food, when we enjoy our food, when we eat it in a pleasant ambiance, in a way that's pleasing. And so part of this process, mindful eating, is not just about eating less food. It's really about enjoying the food more.
So if I am really hungry and I've had that first bite, how do I keep the second and 12th and 20th bite interesting?
Well, I'll tell you what, sometimes that 12th and 20th bite are way too much food. So one of the things that I teach people is if you're finding it really hard to maintain your attention on the food, there's a fairly good chance that you're done, that your body doesn't need it anymore. We have these adaptive mechanisms, and as you talked about before, we can really only fully pay attention to a limited amount of information at a time. So our body is very, very acutely aware of the smell of food, the sight of food, the taste of food when we're hungry. But as that hunger is satisfied and our needs are met, then our brain becomes prepared to turn its attention to the next thing, whatever it is that needs to occur next. So when you find yourself really distracted, it's time to stop eating.
I remember the manual saying it takes about 20 minutes for your stomach to give feedback to your brain. Is that true? And if so, do we need to eat slowly just to allow time for that process?
It varies from person to person. The more physically aware of your body, the more you'll notice satisfaction occurring, even before the chemical signals are there. But I think for most of us, there really is a delayed reaction. And the way that you know this is if you've ever overeaten and felt totally miserable afterward and regretful, then you know that it took time for you to become aware of that. Because none of us would continue to eat after the point when we're already feeling so stuffed. So clearly we're eating and not recognizing that sensation. So slowing down not only helps us not beat our brain to the punch, so to speak, but it also helps us enjoy the food more. So we're getting that satisfaction. It's taking longer. A good example of this is a woman I met yesterday who was in Europe and slipped and broke her right arm while she was on her trip. And she was saying to me that now when she eats, she can only use her left hand. Well, since she's right-handed, it slowed down the process so much that she realizes that she's not hungry for the rest of her food and she doesn't want to bother with dessert. It's been a total revelation for her.
So now you have a totally new therapy, one hand tied behind your back therapy.
I told her, can I use that in my next book?
This may sound like a silly question, but I'm sincere about it. If I'm having lunch with a friend or dinner with my family, I don't want to say, well, I can't talk to you right now. I'm fully experiencing this bite. How do you balance the social aspects of eating with being mindful of what you're eating?
It's not a silly question at all. It's actually a very important question. And it's about shifting our attention back and forth from one thing to the other. First off, from a very pragmatic standpoint, it's rude to eat and talk at the same time. Although people do it, and as you look around a restaurant, you'll see people shoveling food while they're talking. It's rude to do that, and it's hard to pay full attention. So a leisurely approach to eating of taking a bite of food, fully savoring that, setting the fork down, engaging in conversation. If the other person is talking and you have food in your mouth, it's really about shifting your attention back and forth and back and forth between their words and what you're experiencing. So it really forces you to slow that process down rather than shoveling to get through it and engage in conversation at the same time. If you have a third factor like the television going on in the background, it's nearly impossible. So it's really critical that you eliminate unnecessary distractions so that you can focus on the important things. And I would say the important things are the food and the people that you're with.
You talk about trashing rules. In this example, do you want to have a rule that says no TV or radio while I'm eating, eat the bite or talk, but don't do both at the same time?
I think that brings up two really good points. First off, radio music might be nice. The ambiance, having that background music might create a nice, pleasant atmosphere, as long as it's not music that's causing you to feel anxious or eat in a fast pace. What I really love that you touched on is this idea that having rules tends to be counterproductive. It tends to backfire, but that's when I create a rule for you. So as the expert in weight management, if I said to you, now, Mike, I don't think that you should ever watch TV while you're eating, now that becomes something that you're trying to resist or manage in your environment. However, if you've tried this, if you've tried mindful eating and you recognize, you know what, the lady's right. When I've got the TV on, I lose track of what I'm eating, and the next thing you know, the food's gone and I don't know where it went. This isn't working for me. I'm not eating in front of the TV anymore. You've now created a rule for yourself based on an experience that you know to be true. You're much more likely to integrate that into your lifestyle long term.
I would footnote that with there's a small minority of people whose self-esteem is so low that they can't quite do it for themselves, but if somebody asks them to do it, somebody that they see as high status or somebody that they care about, they can do it for them. I think we see a lot of that with personal trainers.
Yeah, and it is a challenge because I think you're right in that sense. The challenge is that when they're doing it for somebody else, it tends to be a more temporary condition unless they have the good fortune of accidentally realizing that, hey, this really does work. I really do like this. I feel better. Then they may continue that behavior on their own. It's that principle that you and I know as locus of control.
Mm-hmm.
Internal locus of control being, this is something I do because it feels right for me, versus that external locus of control, meaning I do it because somebody else is making me or because there's something outside of myself that is enforcing this behavior. I guess the trick is figuring out what works for you and then experiencing it and trying to make it part of your own behavior because it serves you well.
And I suspect you do a lot of this in your assessment. That part gets into taking a good history of what's worked for you in the past in changing behaviors and achieving things, and then seeing if you can steal that structure and use it with mindful eating and weight loss as well.
Well, it's always about knowing how you function best and then trying to create that structure for yourself. But look at how powerful that is. We just said it's about knowing what works for you and creating that structure for yourself. And if you know you work best when you've got a champion, when you've got an encourager like a personal trainer or a therapist or a coach, then you set that up for yourself. But you're still in charge of it. It's not somebody else making you do it. When somebody calls me on the phone and says, I need accountability, I want you to weigh me every week, and I want you to say, you know, that's not what I do. That's not my job. My job is to teach you how to be accountable to yourself.
You don't want to be a mommy, huh?
No, I already have two kids of my own. Thank you very much.
Anything else that we should know about what to do in that restaurant or at that family dinner to make sure that we're fully mindful of eating?
It's a whole big topic, and I hope we have a little bit more time to talk about it. But part of enjoying food is being really conscious of what you choose. So oftentimes when we're playing this mental game of how many calories, what I've eaten, is this bad for me, is this good for me, we sometimes sway to the side of making choices based purely on what I should eat, and we don't consider what I want to eat. But I don't know about you, if I really, 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 really want something and I choose something else because I should, that thing that I wanted just keeps showing up in my life. It shows up in the break room. It shows up on the next restaurant menu. It shows up on the commercials on TV. And I find that for me personally, that I feel that I want that food even more. When I finally get around to it, I may end up eating it too fast, too much of it, and not enjoy it fully. So I think that one of the things that we really have to do is consider the fact that sometimes when we really want a food, despite the fact that it may be not the best nutritional choice, we're going to feel more satisfied having a little bit of it right then and then making other choices in the future that lead us toward balance, variety, and moderation.
One of the popular things these days is you attract what you want. This sounds like the downside of you attract what you want.
Yeah, exactly. The law of attraction works in both directions. Whatever you're thinking about seems to be what shows up. And it doesn't matter if you're thinking, I don't want to eat that or I shouldn't eat that. If you're thinking about it, it shows up.
What are we supposed to do with all of the things we've read about calories and food pyramids and all of that theory?
What I think helps a lot of people is to ask themselves three questions. The first question, when you feel like eating and you're hungry, is what do I want? That's the first question. First, just take a quick scan of what you feel hungry for. Sometimes what you want might be related to a billboard you saw as you were driving to work. Or it might be that you've been under a lot of stress and you're looking for kind of a comfort food. Wanting a comfort food doesn't mean that there's something totally wrong with you. It may be that you're actually hungry and that comfort food reminds you of days when mom used to cook for you.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that you want something light and fresh because you've been eating too heavily lately and your body wisdom is just telling you, I really feel like having some vegetables or I really need some protein, that body wisdom that we tend not to trust anymore. So asking what I want is the first question. But I need to ask the second question, which is, what do I need? This is where all this nutrition information that we've learned or we've heard comes into play. So we might say to ourselves, well, gosh, I really feel like I want ice cream, but I've already had too much saturated fat today. In that case, eating a full-strength Häagen-Dazs might just be too much saturated fat. But would frozen yogurt do the job? Would that make me satisfied with the desire for ice cream, but my need to balance my saturated fat intake? Also, what do I need allows us to consider, well, what am I allergic to? How do I feel when I eat certain foods? If I eat too much pasta, I'll be sleeping in my meeting this afternoon. I have to run this afternoon to get ready for my half marathon. I need to train today. I don't want to eat a big, heavy meal. So what do I need allows us to take into consideration all those other issues, all those health bits of information. And then that last question, what do I have, is really important because a lot of people in our rush world are not prepared with tasty, healthy, appealing foods. So it doesn't matter what they want. It doesn't matter what they need. All they have is the candy machine down the hall or McDonald's on the corner or the frozen food in the refrigerator. So being prepared with foods that fit into our personal health goals and our desire to enjoy the foods that we eat really makes it much more practical and effective in a busy day.
So our three questions cover emotions, logic, and logistics.
pretty much puts it down. Although, again, what do I want may not be just an emotional need. I think there we have some innate, some intuitive body wisdom that over time we've forgot, we've learned to ignore. That we oftentimes trust the authority, the expert, more than we trust ourselves. And I think that part of this process is about learning to trust our own innate wisdom.
So in somebody who is very, very attuned to their body might even be telling them of certain minerals or vitamins that they're short of and wanting those foods.
Well, we survived many, many centuries before they even knew what vitamins were. That information only became available in the early 1900s. So somehow we intuitively figured it out. Now, granted, we're living longer, but we did, for a while there, do pretty well without a guidebook.
That's like one of the flow cartoons I saw. She says, Grandma, we're so smart. We've got television and computers and everything. What did your generation do? And she said, well, we invented them.
Exactly.
Let's take a break for a moment. This is America's anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, with Ageless Lifestyles Radio. Today's guest is Am I Hungry author, Dr. Michelle May. You can learn about her books, workshops, coaching programs, and the lectures and seminars she does at amihungry.com. That's amihungry.com. And again, her flagship book is Am I Hungry, which not only is on her website, but Amazon and most bookstores. I'd love to meet you in person. How do you do that? Simple. Get your employer or professional organization to have you come in and do a seminar. I love to do seminars with employers, professional organizations, hospitals, civic groups, and retirement communities. Some of the topics include centenarian secrets for being youthful at every age, social perks of being over 50, life makeovers from the inside out, grow young by changing your mind, helping our patients and ourselves age well, and grumpy old men and women in the workplace. Find out more, check out anti-aging-speaker.com, where you'll also find some demo videos. That site again is anti-aging-speaker.com. Hope to see you soon. Now back to our interview with Dr. May. Dr. May, do those three rules pretty well cover it, or are there other things that we need to know?
I wouldn't even call them rules, but let's say they're
questions. Excuse me, three questions.
What do I want? What do I need? What do I have? Now, one of the fun things that I do when I'm working with people is I have them think back to their perfect day on a diet or the day that they ate perfectly, whatever their standard is for what that is. And it's funny, but it's kind of a common experience. People say, well, I had bran cereal, or they'll say, I had an egg, and I had a little bit of yogurt, and then for a snack, I had an apple, and then for my lunch, I had salad with dressing on the side, a little bit of chicken breast, and strawberries for dessert, and then for dinner, I had 3 ounces of fish, and some brown rice, and some broccoli, and for dessert after that, I had an orange, you know, this kind of perfect, rigid plan that they followed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll follow that question by asking them.
I didn't think it sounded real, but...
Yeah, exactly. You know, certainly nobody would argue with the fact that, wow, that does sound like something a dietitian would come up with, right? I mean, that mm-hmm. sounds like a very, very perfect, balanced day. But it also sounds pretty mundane, pretty boring, and for many people would be very difficult to maintain long term. So then the other aspect is, okay, well, what did you eat on your worst day? And it's amazing. A lot of people will say, well, it started with the bran cereal or the hard-boiled egg.
Uh-huh.
It started the same way as the good day, and then something just went downhill. It's amazing how often I'll hear people describe eating an entire pizza or a 12-ounce sirloin, baked potato loaded, piece of cheesecake, several glasses of wine, popcorn at the movie, just the complete opposite direction.
So what do you do with those answers from those two questions?
The image to me is this swinging pendulum, all the way from good to bad, good to bad, and people will go back and forth swinging wildly from one extreme to the other. So my question is, what could you eat on every single day of your life that would have the healthy components of that quote-unquote good day and the fun, the enjoyable components from that quote-unquote bad day, and you can tell by my quotes that I don't like the terms good and bad, but what could you choose from those days that would help your pendulum swing in a more narrow arc down toward the bottom so you're not swinging wildly from one direction to the other? And oftentimes people will realize, you know what, that healthy breakfast is very satisfying for me. I feel good when I start my day that way. And I'm perfectly happy to keep fruit on hand for my snacks. But you know what, putting my dressing on the side or using low-cal dressing that's flavorless and never varying what I have for lunch gets boring, and it starts making me miss the fast food my friends are eating. I could have a couple pieces of pizza for lunch once in a while. I could order the children's Donald's meal and French fries once in a while instead of the triple decker with the large fries on those times when I give up on my diet. So again, it's really about helping people find some balance between eating for enjoyment and eating for health.
That seems to be the real goal, avoiding the big swings and having a more balanced approach to eating with the mindfulness.
Exactly. When I consider what I want and consider what I need, my body naturally moves toward balance, variety, and moderation in my diet. So I don't eat a piece of chocolate cake and then feel guilty and then think, oh, well, I've already blown it. I'm going to eat the other piece of chocolate cake that's sitting here. I think, oh, that was so delicious. I'm so glad that I got to enjoy that. And then I move on to my next activity, no longer worrying about the calories or the guilt that's associated with it. In the long run, I eat a lot less because I'm not paying penance all the time.
Do you teach people to have circuit breakers that, gee, if your boss yells at you, you know that's a 10 on the emotional scale, so be ready with, here's how I'm going to handle it in terms of eating, rather than just try to follow our, well, let's be mindful and not go to extremes?
You know what, that's actually the whole point of this whole process, is that it's not really about the weight. The work that I do isn't so much about weight loss. It's really about learning to take better care of our needs, and that means all of our needs. When people are using food to deal with stress, to deal with that tough boss, they're not really dealing with stress, and they're not really dealing with that tough boss. So the stress keeps coming back. The boss is never fully handled. So it remains an ongoing stressor. So now not only am I gaining weight and eating in an unsatisfying way, but I'm not dealing with my life situation either. So the beauty of this process isn't just that people lose weight. The beauty of it is that they begin to recognize when they're using food for emotional reasons and where other activities, as you suggest, these circuit breakers, might meet their needs better. Food's a whole lot more satisfying when you're eating because you're hungry. And stress reduction works much better than food when you're actually feeling like eating because your boss is a jerk.
So you'd prefer not to use a term like circuit breakers, but rather increasing awareness of when you're reacting emotionally and turning to food for comfort.
Exactly. It's that recognition of head hunger versus physical hunger. It's that recognition that certain things cause me to reach for food in order to feel better. I'm a human being. I deserve to feel better, but in the long run, the food doesn't really do the trick. I need to find something that's going to work better for me. So ultimately, it's not really about being good. It's about feeling good.
When people talk about mindfulness, a lot of it is about the mental chatter that goes on. When you talk to yourself about food or weight, are you or people typically talking to themselves, to a renegade part of themselves, to their logical self? What's typical in this chatter?
The chatter is so ingrained that it's all of the above, and it comes from so many different directions. Interestingly, some of our chatter was built in through our childhood. Funny, I had a woman that I was working with who was really struggling. She was Italian, loved her pasta, and was finding that this was a big struggle for her. She couldn't seem to get that under control. When she became aware of her mental chatter, what she realized is that her mother always told her, you can't have the butter noodles until you've had your pasta with tomato sauce. In other words, you've got to eat the healthy stuff before you can have the treat that you really like the best.
Mm-hmm.
So what she was doing as an adult, a 50-something-year-old adult, was she would go out for pasta, and she would make pasta on her own. She would have it with a lovely marinara sauce, and then she would have the fattening brown butter or fettuccine or whatever it was that she was looking for. So she was eating twice as much as she needed. As soon as she realized that that mental chatter no longer applied, she did not need to limit her pasta. Her mother didn't have the right to decide anymore what she ate. She would just have her brown butter pasta if that's what she really wanted. And she said, I cut my pasta intake into about a third of what I was eating before.
So what you teach people to do with the mental chatter is to listen to it and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, sometimes it's about figuring out what's going on. Sometimes it's about just being aware of what it is. Sometimes just the awareness, we can almost just laugh and go, oh, that doesn't apply anymore, or how silly, or wow, that's not very helpful, or oh, isn't that interesting. To a certain extent, sometimes mindfulness isn't really about doing anything. It's about just sitting in that. So if it's discomfort or guilt or whatever, just being aware that that emotion is there. And amazingly, emotions tend to ebb and flow. So suddenly it just starts to recede just by our simple attention to it.
You can't sustain it forever, no.
Exactly. Exactly.
The idea of trashing the rules, I suspect for a lot of people, it feels like you're going out in a higher wire without a net. The concept is appealing. Everyone wants to get rid of rules in their life, but you feel like, gee, I've struggled with keeping the weight off, and this is the one circuit breaker I had to protect me, and you're going to take it away. How do you feel comfortable with letting go of those rules?
Two things. The first is, first, find a model in your life for somebody who manages their weight effortlessly. It's important to be able to convince yourself that indeed there are a lot of people in this world who don't have to think about all of this stuff all the time. They're not constantly chattering to themselves about food. They're not thinking about food all the time. They don't weigh and measure. They eat whatever they want. When you can find a model like that in your life, it becomes really reassuring, because what we realize then is that we all started out that way. All of us as babies had the ability to manage our weight effortlessly. We didn't eat food we didn't like. We didn't overeat food we loved. And on those occasions when we did, we weren't hungry for dinner and we just refused to eat it, even if our mom tried to get us to eat it. So we all started with that ability. And really, this process is not some wow revolutionary process. It's about going back to our instinctive natural roots.
It's more extreme than that. When we were babies, if we didn't want it, we threw it.
Exactly. Spit it out, throw it, refuse. It was so natural for us to be able to set limits to how much food we ate, because it didn't feel good to overeat. We didn't like the feeling of being sluggish or full. We had playing to do, you know? And then the other piece of that is to just ask yourself, you know, is this really working for me? If I have to look at myself 5 years down the road, do I still want to be thinking about every morsel of food I put in my mouth? Do I still want to feel guilty every time I eat a chocolate chip cookie? Is it really helping me? And what most people realize is they've been feeling guilty and thinking about food for decades, oftentimes, just absolutely decades. And the thought of continuing to live their lives like that when there's the possibility that you might be able to come back to a peaceful relationship with food, it's a no-brainer.
You make it sound like Groundhog Day.
All over again.
The movie where he lives the same day over and over again.
Yeah, well, and isn't that old wise adage? If you do what you always done, you're going to get what you always got. So you keep the dieting, keep the restriction. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So every time we restrict, we're giving more power to the food. It draws us back in, and we find ourselves overeating and then having to go back to the restriction. That yo-yo dieting, as it's called, or I call it cycle switching, is so unproductive, and it steals our energy from the important things that we need to be doing to be happy.
It's vacation season. When we go on vacation, do we need to be thinking differently?
No, that's the great thing about this process. When you're a dieter, vacations become one of two things. They either become a vacation from the diet, in which people just expect that they're going to gain 5 pounds on their cruise, or they become this landmine of things that they have to avoid. People they have to avoid, restaurants they have to avoid, dressings they have to order on the side. It becomes this entire landmine. The beauty of this process of eating like this is that when you use hunger and satisfaction to guide your portions, when you use what do I want, what do I need, what do I have to determine what you're going to choose, you don't need any other guidelines whatsoever, because you can figure out in any situation, a cruise, a wedding, a vacation, a grandmother's house, you can figure out exactly what to eat based on what your body is telling you at that moment in time.
So if you've already developed the system, then the whole thing gets finessed when you're on vacation.
Exactly. It's a great time for practicing. In fact, I just got back from a three-week trip down under where my husband's family lives, and it was just an amazing opportunity to try all kinds of wonderful foods that I had never had or hadn't had in a long time since our last trip. It was an amazing opportunity to connect with my in-laws over foods that they prepared for us. There was none of this waffling about, oh, I shouldn't eat that, or pretending not to eat it, or grumbling under my breath because there wasn't anything allowed on my diet. It was this total enjoyment, this engagement in the relationships, enjoying the food, but never overeating to the point where I ruined a perfectly good meal by feeling miserable afterward.
I love that concept of ruining a perfectly good meal by eating too much.
Isn't it, though? People say, oh, I can't lose weight because I love food too much. But just think about how often we love food to death. I mean, to the point where we eat everything that's on our plate long after it tastes good, long after we're able to pay attention to it because our brain is on to the next thing, and then we feel so miserable afterward. Instead of remembering how delicious it was, we're thinking, why did I do that?
I have this image of filling the gas tank and it's just pouring out all over the ground.
Exactly. Except, unfortunately, our gas doesn't pour out onto the ground. It spills out over our belt buckle.
So we're on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. We are hungry, and all they have is the fast food stops. Anything special we do now?
Yeah, that's great, because here we are in a situation where we might know what we want and we might know what we need, but we only have a limited menu to choose from. So in that situation, you still ask yourself, what do I want and what do I need first? And then you look at the menu to see if you can find something that matches. One of the struggles that a lot of us have is that we live in an abundant food environment. So there's all kinds of food and restaurant marketers, their job is to get us to buy the things that they want us to buy. So if we look at the menu first, if we look at the ads in the window, whatever the 99-cent deal is, then we end up choosing what the marketers want us to buy. If we pull into the parking lot and before we go in, we stop for a second, we first check in, make sure we actually are hungry. We kind of get a gauge on how hungry we are. That'll help us decide how much we need to order. And then we say, well, what do I want? And the first thing that pops in our mind is something salty, crunchy. Well, I got to find something that's going to be salty, crunchy. And then what do I need? Well, I prefer not to eat any fried food. I need to be alert to drive. Then we walk in and we're looking for something on the menu that has a little bit of salt, a little bit of crunch, and isn't going to make me feel drowsy and groggy when I'm done. I don't know what that's going to be. It depends on what's on the menu. But surely with that perspective, it's easier to make a choice.
And we're back to our three questions.
It works in any situation.
Anything special about going into a Starbucks?
I think Starbucks is about coffee. I don't think it's about frappes and ice, essentially what works out to be coffee ice cream or danishes or scones. I think Starbucks made their original mark on having great coffee. So if you're pulling in to get your coffee, enjoy it. If you are hungry, Starbucks is no place to go as far as I'm concerned.
So don't order Chinese when you go to a steakhouse.
Exactly.
To me, one of the most dangerous places to be is in a bakery, and there you have all the aromas too. Any advice for bakeries?
let me take one step back and say that part of what you just gave a great example of is how we set ourselves up. So that thinking process, we say to ourselves, ooh, a bakery is a dangerous place, or, ooh, I always overeat cookies. Now we've given our brain instructions, haven't we? We've told our brain, ooh, I'm always going to overeat cookies, or, ooh, I always get into trouble when I'm in a bakery. So the most important thing we can do before we ever step foot in there is to reframe and be aware of what our thoughts are. So instead, we might walk in through that bakery door and say, oh, a bakery, fresh baked delicious foods that I didn't have to make and that I can order in the perfect portion size. I love hot chocolate chip cookies, and I won't have to deal with a batch of 36. I can buy one or two and enjoy them and be done with it. You see how that simple reframing of what do I want? I want chocolate chip cookies. What do I need? I only need two. I don't need 36. This is perfect. Fantastic.
I love it.
You see what I mean?
It's wonderful. We've been talking with Dr. Michelle May, author of Am I Hungry? She also does coaching and lecturing and trains trainers on how to use her system. Her website is amihungry.com. That's amihungry.com, which is also, without the com, the name of her flagship book, Am I Hungry? Dr. May, I confess I have a fantasy about you. You're this little Jiminy Cricket character sitting on people's shoulders, saying, always let your conscience be your guide. Be mindful.
I love that. I so often that I have people say to me, you're in my head. You're walking in my head. I hear your voice saying these things. And what that tells me is that they're internalizing messages that resonate for them. Those messages, that important wisdom is becoming part of their own thought process. And I love that. I love that people can learn to let their own conscience be their guide.
So this isn't a dark Manchurian candidate. This is positive and mind control.
Exactly, yeah. No control here. It's a subtle difference. I talk about the difference between being in control, which is doing the right thing all the time, versus being out of control, which is feeling like I have no sense of what it is that I'm supposed to do. I have no control over it. What we're really trying to teach people is that you're in charge of your decisions. And that means that you can make a decision to eat a food, even if it's not particularly healthy, but you're making that decision to eat it in a way that's enjoyable without guilt. And that the next decision that you make might be to have that salad with the dressing on the side because you're the one who's making the decision.
It's just such a positive, liberating system. Thank you for sharing it with us and sharing all your experience, all the things you've learned.
My pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And now for my commentary on the interview with Dr. May. Diet and weight loss advice is the Tower of Babel. I don't know who thinks we're stupider, the politicians with their pandering promises or the diet gurus with their diet of the month and magic pills. It sells magazines, it sells pills, and it sells special foods, but in the long run, it leaves the vast majority of us jaded, defeated, and still overweight. I love the way Dr. May's approach finesses the whole diet issue. There are no diets, just three simple questions. What do I want? What do I need? And what do I have? I find myself asking myself those questions more and more often, and I like the results. It effortlessly takes you down the path to more mindful eating. Now, some of the times you're going to be so cranked up, you're going to say those phrases, and it's just not going to register. It's not going to make any difference. But the more often you say it, the more often it becomes habitual, the more opportunities there are for that kind of connection. Let me make an analogy with prayer. A lot of clergy will tell you that if you wait until you feel like praying, boy, you got a long wait and something bad has to happen. But people who pray every day are far more likely to hit those times when the prayer really does connect. Or for that matter, the prayer is more likely to connect much or even most of the time. Thus, I think the more that you ask yourself those questions, the more it's going to contribute to more mindful eating. That inevitably is going to lead to better health and a healthier weight. Now that it's true, what's salubrious for one person may be harmful for another, being more mindful helps you find how your body reacts to what you eat. It helps you notice it more. If I had any reservations about Dr. May's approach, I'd certainly say so, but I think it truly is the best approach that I've seen to healthy eating and to weight loss. Of course, exercise is important too, but that's for another program. Baby steps. In our quest to help you live longer, healthier, and happier, I try to find little baby steps that you can do, little tweaks in your habits that'll help you live longer, healthier, and happier. And today we have two. The first is very simple. Trash the idea of diets. If you've been on one diet, you've probably been on dozens and dozens, maybe even hundreds of diets. If you're still considering any diets, it's obvious they don't work for you, at least not in the long run. Gee, think of how much time people can save by not reading all those articles in the magazines about the latest fad diets. Second baby step is to use the three questions. What could be simpler? What do I want? What do I need? What do I have? The more you use those three questions before you eat, the more likely you are to become healthier and to lose weight if that's your goal as well. They're also very good questions to ask yourself right before you go to the grocery store. Emails. You know I love emails. The emails focused on our interview last week with Dr. Ruth Ann Russo, author of The Raw Food Myth. And the most common email said, you talked a lot about how fair and balanced Dr. Russo was in her book, but your commentary raised a lot of concerns about the raw food movement. What gives? Well, that's a great question. I really wasn't very familiar with raw food, so I started with Dr. Russo's book. And indeed, it was very fair and balanced in discussing all the controversies within the raw food movement, the leadership in the raw food movement, and how and why people had sect-like disagreements about eating and about raw food. After the interview, I felt uncomfortable about some of the assumptions, such as jumping from Carillion photography to foods being alive and dead. I also had difficulty with the idea of cooking destroying enzymes. They're talking about the enzymes that are in the plant food. Other than what digestion happens in your mouth, the hydrochloric acid in your stomach is so strong that it's probably going to deactivate any enzymes. Consequently, your body produces its own enzymes for digestion. Some of the other considerations were in whether everyone can afford the extra cost of organic food and raw food, the advantages of cooking, namely killing germs and making food softer and easier to chew, and in some cases easier to digest, the possible effects on your teeth, and finally how it draws you into a counterculture, which may or may not fit with your overall values and the lifestyle you want to live. Thus, I still think Dr. Russo's book is a very good introduction to the movement and takes a very gentle, okay to wade in to pick and choose approach. If you want a balanced critique to the raw food movement, that's a little harder to find. There are dozens, probably hundreds of books promoting raw food. There's very little incentive for someone to write a critique. If the raw food movement gets really big, I wouldn't be surprised to see the beef industry and some of the food industry step in and really crank up the critiques. But at this point, they probably feel it would create more animosity than it would help sell their products. My overall take is there are a lot of good ideas in the raw food movement. We all would be better off eating more fruits and vegetables. Anytime you take something to an extreme, however, you tend to run into problems. Do send those emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. The latest programs are on webtalkradio.net, and all the programs are archived on agelesslifestyles.com. At agelesslifestyles.com or drbricky.com, that's drbricky.com, you can sign up for my free email newsletter, the Defy Aging Newsletter, that gives you practical advice on how to think, feel, look, and be more youthful. This is Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.